of two statements of Chazal, which at least on the surface seem difficult. And the first is that in the days of the Mashiach, the Rama maintains that all of the Tanakh, all the books of Nach, with the exception of the Torah, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, will be nullified, except for the Megillah. So there will only be two books, two Kitvei HaKodesh, two books of Scripture, which is the Chamisha Chumshei Torah and the Megillah. So of course the question is, why the Megillah of all these books? What's so unique about that? And the second issue is the statement of the Gemara in Shabbos Peches that says that Vayisyasu B'sachta Sahar, that the Chazal say that at Har Sinai the Jews were coerced. That God said to them, so to speak, if you accept the Torah, it'll be good. If not, I'll turn the mountain over you like a tank, and this will be your grave. Which indicates that they accepted it out of coercion, which is a problem in its own right, because if you read the plain story, it seems to be clearly a voluntary acceptance. And nevertheless, the Gemara says, in the days of Purim, they accepted it again. And this time, Rashi and Tosis point out, they accepted it out of love. Because it says, Kimu v'kiblu. That they were makabal, they accepted. Kimu masha kiblu kfar. They affirmed that which they had previously accepted. So it was a new acceptance. And Rashi and Tosis point out, because of the love of the miracle. Now that itself is problematical, because if you compare the miracle of Sinai to the miracle of Purim, there doesn't need to be any comparison. The miracle of Sinai was the greatest expression of greatest revelation in our history in terms of greatness of a miracle. Whereas, contrarily, if you read the story of the Megillah, it doesn't seem that there was any overt miracle. Although the entire sequence of events was miraculous in that it was under the providence, Ashkacha, but you can't compare the character of the miracles. So those are the two main issues we're going to try and work back to. Okay. I want to approach it through an analysis of the strategy of Esther. The strategy of Esther. Because you're familiar with the chain of events, more or less, in the story of the party that Ahasuerus had thrown, and what took place at the party, you know, the tremendous indulgence, extravagance, and so on and so forth. So you're introduced to the character of Ahasuerus. Then you have a key event in the development is his command to Vashti and her refusal. And then he seeks the advice of his counselors. And this Memuchan. Now, Chazal say that Memuchan is Haman. That that was his name before he was appointed, before he was to that position of power. So he advises him to kill Vashti, because this is an act, the way he presents it, it's a very serious act of insubordination. It just can't be tolerated. If the word gets out, it'll break down the whole structure of the societal order. The women will no longer respect the men, and so forth. So the king takes the advice. Then, of course, you know what happens. What happens is that, like in many similar situations, the wine, he was under the influence when he accepted the decision. Decision made perfect sense to him when he was in that state of mind. Right? But what happens afterwards? See, when his anger subsided, his anger at Vashti subsided, then, you see, this is a perfect example of how the Rasha operates. He operates by the emotion of the moment. And he has to gratify. That's a key feature in the story here, as we'll see. He has to gratify the emotion of the moment. Then Zachar as Vashti v'yesa Asher asasa v'yesa shenigzer alav. Then he remembered. Then he was upset. So he operates on the basis of a powerful emotion, and he doesn't take into consideration all the factors, the long range picture. That's a very important thing. That's why most people live their lives. In other words, they judge whether to do something or not to do something on the basis of the immediate. But not on the basis of the long, is it going to make me happy in the long run? has a totally different perspective to look at it. You see, when most people go after something, whether it's a, you know, whether it's a, an object, a job, a position, whatever it is, it's very often there's a very powerful. You have to. You should be suspicious about that when you have that powerful feeling. Very powerful feeling. I must have this. And then very often, after a while, you have a totally different look, totally different feeling, because you're repressing all the other factors. And a chacham will take into consideration, will take everything, will take that emotion into consideration, but he tries to know himself, and he tries to study all of the factors to imagine. You see, it's very difficult to imagine what you're going to be like in the situation when this feeling is no longer present. See, because you don't assume that's going to happen. You assume that the feeling that you have right now is going to last forever. But you should always try and view the situation once that feeling is no longer there. That's a very important factor. It's a musa haskil in and of itself. When people decide to invest, to buy something, and they're willing to take on the responsibilities of something, they have a very powerful feeling. Very powerful. Of course, so that emotion, with that emotion, everything else seems to be... worth it. It seems to be reasonable. It's worth it. But what happens is they're assuming that that emotion is going to remain in force, you know, indefinitely. And then what happens is they, after a while, they regret. They feel terribly burdened there, and they're not enjoying the thing the way they don't imagine. What happened, of course, is that the emotion subsided. Now they're stuck with the payments. So it's very rare that a person, when he's making a big decision in life, is able to put aside. That's what a person should do, though. If to whatever extent possible, he should try and get a different look at the situation, how it looks absent that very powerful emotion. To also understand the emotion doesn't mean to say reality doesn't mean the emotion may still be there, but it'll be weaker. But to take into consideration how the emotion is going to develop and what the situation will be like afterwards. All the events, the key events that we have to be aware of course, is that that's significant in the framework of the story, is that that brings Esther into a position of power. Of course, that's a crucial phenomenon. Alright? So the basic sequence of events is the destruction of Vashti and the selection of Esther. Now Esther is the queen. We have the sudden elevation of Haman. It comes out of nowhere, and it's a tremendous elevation, tremendous power and honor, and everybody has to bow down to him. And the significance of that seems to be with regard to the story of Mordechai. Mordechai refuses to bow. And that too, I believe, requires analysis. Why did Mordechai? It doesn't tell us, other than the fact the servants keep asking him, "Madua ata over?" I just raised the question on Shabbos. It seems, at least on the surface, one can ask the question here, that there doesn't seem to be consistency within Mordechai's position, because right before this, there's a little, what seems to be a digression. It doesn't even seem to be that significant. This little story about Bigson and Seresh was thrown in. These two individuals who sought to assassinate, a conspiracy against the king. And Mordechai overheard. And he reports the incident to Esther. And Esther reports it to the king in the name of Mordechai. And then the matter is investigated, and they discover the conspiracy, and they kill them, and thus the life of the king is saved. There's only at that point in time we're not really clear what's so important about the whole story and why it has to be told. Of course, it becomes important later on because it's written down. It's recorded in the history of the official history of the kingdom. Now, you could ask the question as to why Mordechai decided to take that step. Why did he report it? In other words, the question is, might it not have been more prudent? Wouldn't it have been more prudent to simply sit back? Let's assume that there was a conspiracy over here. It wasn't just two people, obviously. There was some type of a coup. And let's say it would have succeeded. If it would have succeeded, then Mordechai would have been in trouble because he reported against them. Yet Mordechai decided to report it anyways. Okay? So clearly, he maintained that it's better. He didn't do so. I mean, the question is, why did he do this? He didn't know. He didn't do so because later on, he knew that there'd be a night, Balayla Ahu, that the king wouldn't be able to sleep, and then he'd be, you know, remember, obviously he didn't know all that. So he was acting on certain principles. So what was the reason, what was the principle that motivated him to do this? The principle over here, although it's not explicit, but there is a principle over here, and that is that it's one of the principles of Torah, that that one should pray for the peace of the government. For were it not for the government, each person would consume himself, his neighbor, each person would consume his neighbor alive. Which means to say, interesting, that's the point that, Mel, you were making this point in one of our recent discussions. In spite of all the criticisms, it's a good point. I heard the point. Anyway, in spite of all of our criticisms, of the system and the government and everything, people, you got to be careful. You got to be on guard against radicals. Don't want to tear the whole system down. You have to be on guard against that. The point was that, and it's a very good point, that it's one thing. Now you have to have context. That's the danger. There's a lot of idealists can be very, very dangerous, and the points can be very true. There is a lot of corruption in the system, but you always have to realize that there's a certain inherent benefit in maintaining the system. People don't, because in a, see, take a look, in those societies where there's constant revolutions, there's turmoil, you can't have the base of civilization. We tend to underestimate, you know, the antisocial forces in human nature, and the instinctual forces. People are basically animalistic by nature, and when you remove the force of government, then we'd be amazed. I think people would be, the average person would deny this. The average person views himself as a nice, law-abiding citizen, you know, who wouldn't harm anybody. He goes to work every day, obeys the laws, and so on and so forth. To tell him that really, if it were not for the policeman, he doesn't think about this consciously. It's all been ingrained in his psyche. If it were not for the policeman and the judges and the jails and so forth, then he would break into his neighbor's house, and God knows what he would do. He would deny that completely. But you see what happens when the lights, you know, we've seen already, even in America, when the lights go out, looting, rioting, how these very same people, in a very short period of time, if you remove all the controls, they could be converted into animals. And
we are animals.
Yeah, well, that's why you do need a powerful system of control. And as far as the Jew is concerned, it's even more important. Because the worst situation for the Jew is when there's a period of upheaval. When there's a period of upheaval and there's different groups that are vying for power, so then it's much worse for the Jew. Political instability, you see indicated between World War I and World War II, the fascist movements. And in those situations, these different, you know, parties and so forth that are vying for power, they're always looking for a scapegoat. The Jew is very vulnerable then, because the Jew becomes the scapegoat. And they whip up the masses. And they always have to find someone who's responsible for our plight. And the Jew is a perfect scapegoat. So I would say that I agree with Sidney on that point, that there's a principle over here. That, unless, of course, you have to know the particulars. If the king was that bad, if you're living in Nazi Germany, you know, obviously we're not going to say, have a misfollowed Shlom Malchus. I mean, every principle has to be approached with Seichel. But, like you said, he wasn't that bad. He wasn't exterminating the Jews. And to therefore, it's very important to maintain the peace, the order of the society. The government, by and large, the government will probably be more protective. Even with the communist regime, they had a vested interest in maintaining order. They're not going to allow these radicals to do whatever they please. But when that authority breaks down, then it becomes more difficult. Of course, what happened over here, even though Ahasuerus was, his rule, his power was maintained, still a decree, in spite of that, the decree did come out to kill the Jews. But that was for a different reason. That was because of the character of Haman. Nevertheless, the reason I bring it up is because it would seem there might be a bit of an inconsistency. Because on the one hand, he seems to be very loyal to the state. The loyalty is the factor which causes him to report what he saw, the conspiracy. But then when it came to obeying the king's command about bowing down to Haman, so then he doesn't do it. And in fact, it would seem that he even endangers. Then he can make the case that he endangers the Jews. Because as a result of his insubordination, he's filled with that. Everything that triggers off the whole series of events which leads to the decree. So isn't there a bit of a contradiction? Why didn't he bow down? Why did he rock the boat? What was going on over here? Chazal say that he wore an avodah zarah around his neck so that it would constitute avodah zarah. I think it's correct. The only thing is, I don't know if I would take it literally. If that was the case, I don't think Haman was enraged. I don't think that Haman's rage. You see, Haman was put into a state of rage. If this is purely a religious thing, and if the whole thing was an issue of bowing down to an idol, then I don't think it would have brought about this result. You see, later on, the proof of this is clearly what bothered Haman was that he wouldn't bow down to him. If it was purely a political gesture to bow down to him and he just happened to be wearing an idol, it just seems to me that this type of a thing could have been explained. But later on, when he's leaving the first party, it says Sameach v'tov lev, and then he saw Mordechai v'lo kam v'lo zom imenu. He didn't stand v'lo zom imenu. He didn't move. He says Vayimolei Haman chema. He was filled with rage. So that had nothing to do with it. It doesn't even say because of bowing down. It's interesting. It says v'lo kam. He didn't get up. V'lo zah. He didn't move. Which of the two? Which one was worse? The fact that he didn't move means that he didn't show any recognition. And now I would say the reason why Mardukhai refused to do it was because Haman really represented Amalek. In other words, he was involved in his whole concept. Of course, Chazal said he wore the idol, but the idol was really him. The whole deification of man, the whole philosophy of self. That's where Mardukhai drew the line. So this has nothing to do with loyalty to the state. This is a matter of the whole ideal that we stand for is the deification of God. And opposed to that are those who, that's Amalek. Amalek represents the group which is opposed to the deification of God and in its place the deification of man. Human might. That's what Haman created, was power hungry. But it wasn't just power for the sake of power. It was a deification of the self. It was an ideology of Amalek. When it comes to that, that's why you see, when it comes to that, there's no compromise. That's a main element in the story. When it comes to fundamental ideals, in terms of our relationship to God, we're prepared to give up our physical existence, because physical existence is just a means to an end. And that's why at no point, I just pointed out yesterday, even later on, it's interesting, the Megillah points out that all this came about, the entire tragedy comes about essentially because of Mordechai's refusal. It has such an impact on Haman. It's amazing how one person not bowing down can cause such a storm. But then when he hears about the decree, when Mordechai hears about the decree, so he puts on sackcloth and ashes and a loud wail, and he imposes upon Esther, and then we'll get into that in a moment. But clearly he does everything possible to sound the alarm bells. We have to do something to save the Jews. Now, interestingly enough, on the second, after on the first night, after Haman is leaving the party, so it mentions again that Haman passes by Mordechai, velo kam velo zom imenu. Now, you might have thought it teaches you something very significant, and that is to say that this was such an important matter of principle that it had nothing to do with the effects that it brought about. You might have thought that in the first instance that the Mordechai resisted because it was a very serious violation, but he really didn't know what it would lead to. You might have said, well, how do you know that it would lead to, this is genocide, they're going to wipe out the entire Jewish people. He wouldn't have gone that far. How far is he willing to go? Had he known, perhaps he would have acted differently. But what do you see from later on? This is after he has sent Esther on a mission to try and rescue the Jews. So you would think, now he bumps into Haman, you would think that he would not, at this point in time, he wouldn't want to do anything to make the situation worse. Right? But no, velo kam velo zom imenu. This is in the face of the decree. In the first instance, he had resisted. It wasn't in the face of the decree. He didn't know. He didn't do it to flaunt them. He just we couldn't show honor because of idolatry, Amalek. But here, the decree was in effect, and he was doing everything in his power to remove it. But there's one thing that he wouldn't do. He wouldn't change his policy with regard to Amalek. You see, he wasn't affected. He wasn't affected by the results. And any type of practical consideration, from a practical standpoint, you would say now is not a time to manifest your principles. No, that's why the behavior of Mordechai is basically as consistent. Okay, so you know the next point is the reaction of Haman. And that itself has to be explained. There's a difficulty in that. What's difficult about the reaction of what's the problem?
Go ahead.
The reaction of Haman, that he was filled with rage, and Vayives Bienav, the whole thing. What's the problem? The question I would ask is the problem, it seems to me, we have to explain, it seems to be a little bit of an overreaction. Because here's a person who was a significant statesman. I mean, he was appointed to a high position. And basically, it seems everybody conformed. But just because one person refused, why would this lead to such a reaction? And it doesn't seem to be that it was practical fear that he's going to foment, you know. Mordechai was a loyal citizen. He didn't go out of his way to arouse resistance against Haman. We have to try and understand that. There's an important point over here. Like, where's the cause and effect? It says, "Va'yivas b'yanev l'shloch yod Mordechai levada." Alright, if he would have executed Mordechai, that's one thing. But to go to such an extent, this is a major undertaking. It's a major operation. And he's very shrewd. He's very clever in getting he knows how to work Ahasuerus to get his permission. He needs his permission. Yeah, but what's motivating him? What's the underlying motivation? The pshat is that this is something which goes against the whole essence of a Haman. The whole lesson of Haman is based, his whole sense of self is based upon the magnification of his own ego. And he has to feel that he has these special qualities. Now, there's a tremendous problem with this type of a thing. What's the problem with that? That it's false. It's not real. And every individual that tries to maintain this philosophy of being having divine qualities, he a certain part of him is a reality principle that knows that it's not true. He knows that it's not true. And therefore, the only way that he has to repress those feelings, and the only way that he can do so is by controlling the world of the subjective reality, the subjective environment. In other words, for him, reality becomes what people... he's living in the world of people. As long as he can get all the people to agree to go along with this, then he feels happy. Because that's his whole reality. Now, the problem with that is that when there comes along a Mordechai, a Yehudi, and he has a certain respect for Mordechai. He knows that Mordechai is not just another individual. Mordechai is a great individual, and Mordechai removes all of his security. It brings out everything that he's trying to repress, and he can't tolerate it. As long as that's why below zami met him. He wouldn't recognize him. He would not lend any credence to this false idea. And that's why every anti-Semite throughout all of history always is going to turn against the Jews. Because the Jews just won't accept it. And there's that grudging respect. See, they won't admit it. But if they didn't have any respect for the Jew, if they believe what they're saying, all the negative things about the Jews, then why would they care about what the Jews think of them? It's only someone, you see, the only time that you're really concerned about what someone thinks about you is because you really, you won't admit it, but you really respect, you really are afraid that this person has something, that this person really reflects the truth. When you're convinced of that, then you have a fear of that person. And take a look, the proof of that is, I take a look at the hay, Yud Gimel, he says it himself, he expresses it. After the first party, now that is the night of the greatest honor. That's the greatest night of his life, when he leaves Sameach for Tov Lev, and he feels so great, he'd been better off had he gone to sleep that night. That was a very important night. but then he spots, what happens? He spots Mordechai. And that's it. As soon as he sees him, his entire happiness goes out the window. He was filled with rage. And he can't take it. So what does he do? What does the Russia do? He tries to gather his friends. See? He's going to try and wipe away the reality that he can't face. Now, what does he tell them? He has to tell them about his greatness. See, that's the essence of Haman, right? His glorious wealth and his wonderful sons, and Gidlo HaMelech, his position. And then what does he say? And then Esther, only the only one that was invited to the party was me. And also tomorrow. Everything, in other words, everything in his life is of no value to him. Whenever everything loses its value, his whole existence has no value every time I see Mordechai the Yehudi. So, what kind of thing is that? Doesn't make any sense. What kind of philosophy is this? A person has everything. A person has everything that he wants. So clearly, these things that he's talking about, they're not the things that he really wants. What he really wants is a certain feeling. He wants to feel that he is supreme. He wants to be worshipped. But as long as you have that person who won't buy it, who won't accept it, then he can't be happy. So there's only one solution. His whole solution is not to look within, and then perhaps maybe your whole philosophy is wrong. It doesn't work. Maybe, see, that's the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha. When the tzaddik is in a tough situation, when things aren't going well, he looks within. The problem is that's the strategy of Esther. Sumo aligned. Before she does anything, first we have to reorient. We're not in line with reality, because this tragedy could not have come upon us if we had not departed from the proper way. So first we have to do tshuva. But the derech of the Rasha is not to look within. If there's something that's bothering you, it's in the external. So just control the external. So that was that led to his doom. I'll show how that fits in later. That leads to his doom. But I think it's clear from that the primary factor, now Moshe, you're right, there could be other factors as well. Practical considerations can add to it. But the primary factor clearly is that he couldn't tolerate it. You see, later on, he couldn't even wait. After the first party, he could not even wait until the 13th of Adar, when Mordechai would have been killed along with the rest of the Jews. And he did something which is very stupid, politically, because the whole idea, that whole idea of making the tree, it leads to his undoing. Yeah, but even had it not led to his undoing, it shows you that he was completely under the control of his emotions at that point. It wasn't a smart thing to do, to go to the king that night. I mean, we look at it from the point of view of the Ashkacha, how it leads to his undoing. But even if you isolate it, and it doesn't lead to any result, it was not a wise thing to do. The smartest thing was to just leave things the way they were. Because he had sold the plan to Achashverosh. Achashverosh had accepted it, and why bring in new factors now? But that shows you what motivated him to do that, to disturb the king in the middle of the night with this crazy request to hang Mordechai immediately. What motivated him to do it was a very powerful personal feeling, to the extent that he couldn't do it. Now, see, according to Moshe, we're going to maintain the argument of practicality. If we're going to maintain the argument of practicality, it's going to be impossible to explain the whole request to hang Mordechai separately, because that does not have any effect on the practicalities. The practicalities, the necessities, the practicalities have all been taken care of with the basic plan to kill out the Jews on the 13th. So then that would take care of everything. So now, but you see, in spite of that, he can't deal with the existence of Mordechai. So it's the very existence of Mordechai that breaks him down. Alright? Now, of course, Vayives Bienov is, Eli, you want to explain. Okay. Ki Gidolo is Am Mordechai. They told him the Am Mordechai. You see, he wasn't stupid. See? He wasn't stupid. He was capable. He knew it. He was a Rasha. He was wicked, which meant that he lived in accordance with evil principles. But he was dangerous because he was smart and he was determined. Now he realized that this was not a personal issue. If it was a personal thing, it's because this is a phenomenon that's Klal Yisrael. People recognize it as a phenomenon of the nation of Israel. This was a national, this wasn't Mordechai as a unique individual who was different than everybody else. And the truth is, if it was that case, he probably could have tolerated it. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. That's debatable. But it was, you see, that's how the Russia operates. If there's one, you can always polish. So there's one Meshuggah in the world with a crazy fellow. What do I care? But what bothers him is people. So he would never recognize a philosophy just because the ideas might have been true. Like in today's world, I mean, it's not, you know, you can't just write a book about a subject. It's who are you, and oh, you're what school of thought, and oh, that's a group. There's got to be a group. Then you belong to that school of thought. You're a conservative, you're a liberal, you know, whatever it may be. So he recognized that it wasn't just Mordechai who happened to have ideas that were totally different than everybody else in the world. If that's the case, it might, I'm not sure how it would have worked out. Maybe he just would have killed Mordechai, maybe he would have ignored him. Could have said he's a Meshuggah. But there was an Am. It was part of a whole nation. It was a philosophy. And as long as that people maintained the philosophy, so that was the real threat. Then he could never achieve what he wanted to achieve. That's the source of the hatred, and that's a powerful hatred. That's the source of the hatred. It's the hatred of those who stand in the way of his own desire for glorification. Let's put it this way. had Mordechai not resisted, then would he have come to this thing of Yesh Tom Echad? Would he have gone ahead anyways and with this plan? It seems clearly that this is the primary cause. This thing doesn't happen overnight. That's what Chazal mean when they say Mamuchan. The term Mamuchan means ready. Before he was elevated, he was ready, so to speak. Which meant, if the Chazal mean like this, that don't look at a Haman as being an aberration of the human race. He's a the seeds of a Haman lies within everybody. That ego, the capacity to magnify the ego, that lies, that phenomenon of deification lies within everybody. The only thing is that most people would say it's crazy, and most people don't maintain this. The reason why they don't maintain it is not because they're perfected, but simply because they don't have the opportunity. Right? You find that in many, many people, once you see how they change completely. People that are very humble, are very decent, are very considerate, and suddenly they're appointed to positions of power, and then you'll find he's not the same person anymore. Suddenly he's totally different. So it has an effect upon the ego. What is it? What does it mean? I mean, they say that power corrupts. You know that famous one, and absolute power corrupts absolute. But I don't know that it, what do you mean it corrupts? It doesn't, you see people that have power and they're not corrupted. But I don't know that power corrupts. It means that corrupt people are affected by power in a negative way. The corruption was always there. A perfected individual, that's by Yosef HaTzadik. It says he was the same Yosef, but Yosef Ayyub Mitzrayim, Rashi says, the same Yosef who was a shepherd, he was a humble shepherd of his father's sheep, he was a tzaddik, he was the same Yosef who rose to the greatest, the position of power in Mitzrayim, and was still humble. Because he was a way of power corrupts. The point is, of course, that there's something in power which has the tendency, the capacity to corrupt, because each person, if he hasn't worked on his ego, so then it means to say that he had the same desires. He had the same tendencies. But he has a reality principle. He can't justify it. He can't go around acting like he's a god if he hasn't done anything. He has to have something to attach it to. So that's what happens. That's Mamuchan. Mamuchan means that the underlying personality was there. All he needed was some basis. It wasn't a true basis, but something that could appeal to his own sense. In his own mind, he could make it. This is it. He's like, once he achieved that position of power, so that triggered off that whole, all those emotions that were there all along. That's what it means that he developed, he made himself into an idol. That's what he was looking for in life. That was his desire. But he couldn't gratify it until he fits in with the whole Chazal that says that he's the one, Mamuchan, that gave that advice to kill Vashti. You see, his only concern was basically for power. So he looked at the matter purely from the standpoint of a insubordination. We can't tolerate that. Because he wants supreme power. And then when he was appointed, then it was Haman. Then he became Haman. The evil person who, because now he had a basis to justify that feeling. I want to describe the elevation of Haman. So it says that this is very important. Pasuk. Bear this pasuk in mind. It's very important later on when we try to understand the strategy of Esther. It says, "Acharei dvarim ela, after these things, Gidal Hamelach Achashverosh as Haman ben Amdasa ha'Agagi, the king promoted Haman ben Amdasa." And he exalted him. He raised him on high. Vayasim es kiso, and he established his seat above all of the officers who were with him. So he put him in a very elevated, exalted position. Then mechalavdei hamelach asher b'shar hamelach, all of the servants of the king who were in the courtyard of the king, korim mishtachim l'haman, would kneel and bow to Haman. Because the king had thus commanded. So again, this idea that does seem to us to be a bit unusual, because it's one thing to give a person a promotion, to give him power, but it seems that he's going above and beyond that which would be normal. He's not just giving him power, he's exalting him. By Anasa'eo, he exalts him. And also he instructs everybody to bow down to him. So he's giving him a tremendous amount of honor and glory, which the kings usually are very tend to be extremely protective of. That's not the kind of thing they like to give to others. They like to reserve that for themselves. That is a bit unusual. That seems a bit excessive. It would seem to me that this should be analyzed. It's a bit excessive. What's the reason for it? Okay. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachrav. Mordechai would not kneel nor bow down. Now take a look at the next psukim. Tell me what is difficult. Vayomru avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech. And the servants of the king, who were in the courtyard of the king, said, so they came to Mordechai. And they said, Madua ata over eis mitzvah samalach. Why are you violating the command of the king? Vayi ka'amram elov yam vayam. And it was when they would say this to him day in and day out, v'lo shama aleihem, and he would not listen to them. What's interesting is that it doesn't record the answer of Mordechai. Well, he doesn't say what he answered. He just said, Madua ata over eis mitzvah samelach. Why are you violating the command of the king? But then it doesn't say what he answered. He doesn't answer them. Then it simply says that they kept repeating this to him day in and day out, but he wouldn't listen to them. And it's not clear. What did they tell him? First it starts off that they asked him a question. Then it says, and as they said it to him, what did they say every day that he didn't listen to? The question? Is that a reference to the question? Then it says, Vayagid l'Haman, then they told it to Haman, Liros, to see Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai, whether the words of Mordechai would prevail. Now again, it's probably what words of Mordechai? Ki higid lahem asher Yehudi, for he had told them that he is a Yehudi. So this is all given as a preamble, right, towards what happens next. What happens next is the reaction. Then the reaction of Haman. Then vayar Haman. Haman saw ki ein Mordechai kareu mishtachav elo, that Mordechai would not kneel nor bow down to him. Vayimolei Haman chema. And he was filled with anger. Then Vayives Bien of Lishloch Yod Mordechai Levado. And then it was unseemly. It was trivial in his eyes to strike out against Mordechai alone. Ki Gidlo Es Am Mordechai. For they had told him the nation of Mordechai. And he sought, then Vayavakesh Haman Lahashmid Es Kala Yehudim. Then he sought to destroy all of the Yehudim Asher B'chal Malchus Achash Ve'orosh Am Mordechai. Ve'orosh, the nation of Mordechai. Let's get back though to the flow of the Psukim. What's going on over here? There's a dialogue. This whole thing begins as a dialogue between the servants of the king. And it says that they asked Mordechai a question. We asked him a question. It doesn't say what he answered. So we don't know what he answered. Then they kept saying, they said something to him day in and day out, but it doesn't tell you what they said. But he wouldn't listen to it, whatever it was that they said. Right? And then it says that they told it to Haman. Apparently Haman did not notice this on his own. The way, again, when you read the story superficially, you get the sense that he was given this appointment, and everybody's bowing down to him, and then he spots Mordechai didn't bow down to him, and he goes crazy. That's not so simple. It didn't happen that way. This was something which was engineered by the Avdei HaMelech. If it were not for the intervention of the servants of the king, then apparently nothing would have happened. Because then they tell Haman. And then after telling Haman, but interesting, what did they tell him? Ki hu Yehudi. That also doesn't fit in so smoothly. Because look at these words, look at this. Vayagidlo Haman, and they told to Haman, Liros, to see Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai, whether the words of Mordechai would prevail. We don't know what words would prevail. It has not told you that. Ki higid l'hamashu Yehudi, for he had told them that he's a Jew. What does that do with anything? For he had told them that he was a Jew.
Well,
because, key is because, or for. What is that? I mean, somebody mentioned that one of the students from the Rambam, where I teach, he didn't ask me, but he asked one of the rabbis, he asked the question that the Pasuk should have ended at that point, Vayagid Lahaman. They told Haman, Liros Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai, to see whether the words of Mordechai would prevail. It should have stopped right there. Why must it say, in addition, Ki Higid Lahem Ashehu Yehudi, for he had told them that he's Jewish? What does that have to do with anything? That's the question that this fellow had asked. Okay? Okay, so let's see if we can make some sense out of it. The Moshe draws our attention to Pasuk Hey. It says, Vayar Haman, Kiyen Mordechai Korea Mashtachav Elo. And Haman saw that that Mordechai did not kneel or bow down to him, and he was filled with anger. This is a good question, in my opinion. Because he's saying, why must the Megillah record this? First of all, I mean, we're dealing with, this is a sophisticated level of government. You're not dealing with petty people. And people in government at the highest levels, they base themselves on accurate information. I mean, in Washington, for example, if an important official... No, but basically, they have to rely on information. They don't have to go and visit the site to see for themselves. I don't know that Bush went over to the to Kuwait during the time of the Gulf. Well, you know,
In fact, he did.
See, it's right. The president will often visit a disaster scene. Over there, though, but you'll see that they will send all the aid and whatever is done in advance. That they're doing purely for political reasons. They make it appear as though that's one of the devices. It's very deceptive. It's to demonstrate a false sense of involvement and concern. And because then they go to the, they wear a helmet, they tour the area like they're really going to, you know, be dispensing information. It's all right. It's a device which they do to demonstrate concern. But the truth of the matter is that they don't wait. They don't have to wait. The Moshe's question is justified. It's not because they don't believe that it happened. It's after the fact. But over here, it's interesting that he would have to see it for himself. Why wouldn't he trust his advisors? Well, so what's the point of that whole pasuk? And yet, you're not dealing with a child over here. Haman is not a child. Haman is a very capable individual. If he was not a capable individual, then he would not have been a danger or a threat. You see that the information did not enrage him, nor did he formulate a policy on the basis of the information. I think it's a very good question. It's interesting also that if it were not for the Avdei HaMelech, they're the provocateurs over here. You know, think about that. It's not a direct, it doesn't seem to come about as a direct or inevitable conflict. It does not have that element, although we think of it that way, of inevitability. It comes about as a result of the intervention of the servants of the king. They play a significant role over here. Right? To summarize, the three questions we're asking are, what did he answer to their question? What was his answer to their question? And what was their persistent thing that they kept repeating day in and day out, which he would not listen to? And then they decide to tell to Haman to see whether his words would prevail. We're not clear what words they're talking about, but in doing that, it seems the reason why they did it was because he told them he's Jewish, which seems to be, who cares? I mean, is that the reason why they wanted to see whether his words would prevail, because he happened to be Jewish? So these are the three questions we want to address over here. It starts off with them asking him a question, and then the next thing is they're telling him something. Were they asking him every day? Karma mail of Yom V'Yom. Is that they kept asking him every day because he wouldn't tell them, or no? It started off with asking, and then he must have given some answer. We have to infer it. And then, Kiyamra mail of Yom V'Yom. Then they told him something every day. So what did they tell him, though, every day? It starts with a question, and then they're telling him. They're urging him every day, and he refuses to listen. We do know that they did take his answer seriously, because then they brought it to Haman to see whether his words would prevail. So they didn't just negate it and throw it out the window. He must have established a position, and then they brought this position to Haman. There seems to be like it started off as an argument between Mordechai and them, and then they bring it to Haman. But we're a little bit in the dark, but I think we can put it together. The question wasn't exactly, why aren't you bowing down? That's not their question. What is their question? Why are you violating the command of the king? That was the question. Because they, apparently they were not that much interested in the bowing down to Haman per se, but rather, yeah, we have to, why are you different? We have to observe the law of the king. It's the law of the king. What right do you have to exempt yourself from the law of the king? That was the question. I don't know that they were lovers of Haman either. I could imagine that they didn't like the idea. And that's probably why there was pressure on him. Because that's how people are. When they have to do something, whenever you have to do something, which you don't like to do, yeah, like, how come you're not doing this? That's clearly, I don't think there was any love for Haman over there.
Right.
But we have no choice. We have to bow down to this guy because of, and what was their motive? What was their motive in, so to speak, in riling up Haman and snitching to him? Apparently, Haman is not aware of what's going on until they bring it to his attention. Okay, so I agree with what Don is saying. I think that we have to infer. Their question to him was, why are you exempt from the command of the king? Why are you violating the laws of the king? Now, what do the Megillah doesn't record his answer, but from the entire context, I think we can infer. What was his answer? Exactly. That Mordechai is very concerned about loyalty to the state. That's an important theme. You see that he had reported the conspiracy of Bigson and Serer. So the idea that we should be misbowel, pray for the welfare of the government and be loyal citizens, that's an important principle of Yahadus. But his answer was that he's not really violating the law of the king, but he has to live in accordance with the laws of a higher king. In other words, it's not a personal thing. It's not because I am flaunting authority. It's just that in this area, when it comes to the area of this ideal of my fidelity to God and to become subservient to a different ideology which partakes of idolatry, that I can't do. I don't know the exact words in which he put it. But he says that this is a different arena. This is my religion. It's a conflict in terms of religion. Okay? Now, so that was the answer to the question. Now, what's ka'amram? What's ki'amram, Elov? Did they accept this and were satisfied? He couldn't appease them, apparently. What's ki'amram? In other words, they couldn't tolerate. You see, they tried to break him. They couldn't tolerate the idea that there was an individual, apparently, that had the courage to do something that they themselves really would have preferred to do also. They didn't want to be subservient to this type of thing. But they lived in fear. They lived in fear of the king. He says, I live in fear of a higher king. I don't live my life that way. I don't live in fear to any human authority. When it comes to these types of, loyalty to the kingship is one thing. But they weren't operating because of loyalty, they were operating because of fear. And when it comes to something like this, I don't live my life on the basis of fear to any human authority. My only fear is fear of God. See, then it became ki'amram, they tried to break him down. See, they couldn't, that was an affront to them as well. On two counts now. First of all, that he was exempted from bowing down to Haman, but more than that, but here's a man of principle. That's an even bigger affront. They can't tolerate that. Here's a man who has the courage to live in accordance with his principles. And they don't. And they're cowards. And they realize that that's a defect in them. But they live in fear of human authority. And here's a man who's proclaiming that there's a higher authority. That's ki'amram, they tried to break him down. The first thing was to try and break him down. Why? Because his idealism, his resistance was something which bothered them psychologically. Made them feel inferior, made them feel like cowards. So that's why ki'amram, elov yom v'yom, they tried to impose it upon him. they figured he could be broken down. They pressured him. Now there's a battle of wills between these two groups. They're trying to pressure him into submission. Because the pragmatist cannot tolerate the idealist. He hates the idealist. That's basically the whole idea of anti-Semitism. He can't stand it. I mean, because every time he sees the idealist, he's doing the correct thing. It makes him feel guilty. It makes him feel like an inferior person. So they want... They're trying to break him down. Then, what does it mean? How do we understand? Then they go to Haman, and they went to Haman. What was the purpose? To see Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai, what the words of Mordechai would prevail. Ki yigid lahamasha Yehudi. For he had told them that he was a Yehudi. Now it's telling you what he had told them. See, those were the words. Then, you see, they were participants in the attempt to destroy him. They wanted to see whether this would hold. They couldn't tolerate that he would be exempted from the rule. So then they went to Haman to see whether his words would prevail, whether this would be acceptable. That is to say, what were the words? So what were the words they told him? It's very important. Ki higilam shu Yehudi. That there's a man out there who refuses to accept this law. Now, why? Because he's a Yehudi. That's extremely important. Because I would say like this, that if they would have simply said that there's an individual out there, it's very, very difficult to understand why a man like Haman would be so enraged because one person refused to bow down to him. So that's in general a question. I mean, it has to make psychological sense. If everybody else is doing his will and 99%, more than 99% are bowing. So what do you care if one person, to go to such an extreme, you have to wipe out an entire race because of that? Clearly, if it was just one individual who was doing it because of a quirk, then I don't think it would have bothered him. It would have bothered him. He could have dealt with it. But whatever, he's different. He's a nonconformist, or he's a meshuggah, or whatever it is. He doesn't. Nobody cares about that. But it's because kihigi lehamashi Yehudi. They tell him, you know, there's another ideology out there. Haman operated in accordance with a certain ideology. He had a certain concept of his own greatness, which was Amalekite, as we said. It was an ideology. That he was a descendant of Amalek. And that's precisely why Haman wouldn't recognize it. Because bowing down to Haman meant recognition of a certain philosophy of life. And that's why he refused to do so, because he maintained the philosophy Hashehu Yehudi. And that's why it became an issue for Haman. If it was just an individual who says, "Look, I'm not the bowing kind. I don't do that. I don't bow to any man." I don't know that Haman would have been so enraged. Let the guy alone. He's not the Mashiach. Who cares?
Or just do away with it.
Better off, yeah. Or do it exactly. But they brought it to him to see whether his words would stand. What were his words? His words were that this is a false ideology. That's what he was saying. This ideology is completely false. I don't live by such an ideology. You guys want to live by it, that's your business. But then Haman had to see for himself. Now that's Moshe's question. At this point in time, it should have been enough to make his move against him. Why does the Megillah record that he saw? See, because the Avadim, because the servants couldn't accept it, they didn't have the courage to embrace it and live by it, and they knew that they would be in subservience, so they'd be in a state of conflict. They wanted to see something happen to Mordechai. It's clear, I don't think it was just that they brought it to Haman just out of pure curiosity to see what's going to take place. You see? They had an agenda over here. They wanted him, they wanted one way or another. One way or another, either people would be given the freedom to decide whether they wanted to bow or not, or else, if that's not the case, then there should not be a Mordechai, because Mordechai is an affront to them. Makes them feel inferior. But what about the next thing? About the Vayar Haman. Vayar Haman. He ain't Mordechai. He saw. You see, it tells you something about the way the Russia functions. In the end, it was basically an expression of his anger. And the anger of the Russia lives in accordance with the senses. He did not experience the anger until he saw it for himself. Then he couldn't tolerate it. He lives in the world of the senses. That's how he lives. You see?
It doesn't say he thought.
Now, and you see later on also, for example, when he leaves, you see how he's affected. He never really rises above the level of the instincts, of the senses. You see later on when he leaves the first party, Sameach V'Tolev, and then his mood is changed instantaneously. From that's the greatest happiness, he goes to the greatest depression. Why? Because he sees. He sees Mordechai, V'lo kam, V'lo zamimenu. And he didn't rise, and he didn't even move. He didn't move. That's a little bit later on, after the first party. And he's filled with anger, and then that jolts him. He can't tolerate it, and he gathers his advisors, and then they decide to build it to get the tree, and it leads. That's the beginning of his downfall. All those, but again, well, you could ask why? Why did he have to see? Didn't he know? Didn't he know that Mordechai was out there, and Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him? What did he see now that he hadn't seen before? What new information was conveyed? See? But he's living in the world of the senses, and when he saw it, had Haman not seen Mordechai, in other words, like this, there are two factors involved. The reason why he has to destroy Mordechai is because Mordechai represents an ideology which is a threat to his ego. But that is not going to make him to move until he's put into an emotional state, until he's put into a certain emotional state of anger and hatred, and that's engendered by the actual sight. If he didn't have to see it, he doesn't live by the abstract. He doesn't live, the Russia does not live in the world of the abstract. He lives in the world of the senses. If it's not part of his sense perception, it's not real. So therefore, that shows you the level of the Russia. As long as it was just in the abstract, that there's somebody out there, he could tolerate it. Because that's the world, he only lives in the world of sense perception, of the physical reality that's tangible to him. Then it becomes real. When he can deny it, he doesn't see it, whatever. When he sees it, then it triggers his emotions, then he acts. That's why he had to see for himself. And when he saw for himself, it put him in a state of anger. But the reason why, that's Vayivez, then the reason why he has to move against the entire Jewish people is precisely because what the servants had, the divrei, liras hayamdu divrei Mordechai, that what he came to see was the expression of the philosophy of Mordechai, ki yigid lamash Yehudi, that it wasn't, he wasn't refusing to bow because of a personal quirk. But rather it was because he was living in accordance with a different philosophy of life, and he didn't recognize this philosophy. What he saw was that he flaunted the rules. It was his flaunting of the law. Haman had managed to get this act of servitude embellished into the law. It was part of the law. And he saw for himself that Mordechai was flaunting this law. And he wasn't just flaunting it. I mean, it wasn't... See, there's two things. If he doesn't... it's one thing not to submit to the law. What Mordechai did was flaunting it. That was the Divrei Mordechai. It wasn't that I can't bend because my back hurts, this, that. It was flaunting it. That's what he told him. He made it very clear. He could have found some kind of excuse why he can't bow.
It's frank, he came out right
he has arthritis, whatever the case is. But he didn't say that. He made it clear why he refused to do so. So it was flaunting of the law. He can't accept this law. This law is not binding upon him because he's living in accordance with a different law. Now, when he saw that, but for Haman just to know that alone would not have had that impact upon him because he's not a man that lives in the world of abstract reality. He's a man that lives in the world of the sight of what he sees in front of him. And that's why everything operates that way. When he saw him that night, he goes crazy. He knew he was out there, and he knew that, didn't he know that if he would pass him, he wouldn't get up in front of him, he wouldn't show him any respect. He knew that, but that didn't mean anything because then he could deny it. But when he actually physically encountered it, then he couldn't tolerate it. He cannot, and that's, and what's the solution? The solution is to change the reality. He's dealing with the world of external reality. The solution was, well, if we can't be happy with the existing reality, so change reality. You see? As opposed to the methodology of the Tzaddik. Of Haman having to see shows he's not an ideologist per se. the ideology is just the justification of certain emotions. And once, as long as those emotions weren't threatened, you see, as long as the emotions weren't threatened, then he wouldn't have to act. But once the emotions were threatened, if he was purely an ideologist, for the sake of ideology, then he wouldn't have to go and see for himself. Then the knowledge would be the factor. But the ideology was just a justification for him to enjoy certain emotions. So it's only when the emotions were threatened that he couldn't feel that good feeling anymore. That's when he swings into action. That shows you clearly that he's not an idealist. In other words, Haman is in a conflict. He can't ignore the thing. The servants are making an issue out of this. He can't ignore it. On the other hand, he's not in a state in which he's going to act upon it, because it has not become an emotional reality for him as yet. So he has no choice. He has to go see. He's drawn to it. He's drawn to see it. He has to go see it. He can't ignore it. And at the same time, he is not going to do anything until he confronts him. There's got to be that confrontation. But perhaps his ego tells him that once he sees me in person, he'll yield. Could be an ego thing as well. That his ego is on the line. So therefore, maybe he's saying to himself, okay, perhaps Mordechai is a big shot, as long as it's not face to face, but I'm going to go there and then we'll see. So there's got to be a confrontation. It could be that even in spite of the confrontation, so he engineers a confrontation. And then when in spite of the confrontation, he still refuses, that's the final blow. So it could be that that's an element as well. The Avdei HaMelech engineered a crisis for him, or a confrontation. And he just could not walk away from it. It had to be resolved. Now, to walk away from it would be to be a real philosopher and say, okay, he has his philosophy, I have mine. That's not homo. Couldn't tolerate it, right? On the other hand, at this point in time, the confrontation, I would say, wasn't complete. Now you have to, 1 second, I'll show him. Let's see. Let's see if we'll stand. See, that's Leros Hayamdu Divrei HaMelech. Let's see. Let's see what this man is made of. Because as of yet, until now, he hasn't had to really face me personally. When he faces me personally, then he'll yield. So he puts himself in a situation of a personal confrontation. Then when he sees that there's absolutely, makes no sense. For Mordechai, there's no difference in the situation when Haman is in front of him or Haman is not in front of him. It has nothing to do with the person of Haman. It doesn't matter. You see two different personalities. For Mordechai, it's just as real when Haman is not there. As he told him. He's not today, and Madu'ah of him was just Mitzvah Samelech, and he subscribes to a higher king. He doesn't accept this. It's not that he's being disloyal. He tried to tell him he's not being disloyal. It's just that this is a different arena. In this arena, he's subservient to God. And apparently, you see, a man like Haman will always assume that other people are just like him. Yeah, that's very nice. He's a big idealist until he confronts me. We'll see what happens when he has to confront me.
Because then Philippians wouldn't do anything.
See, what you see from this is that the reason... politics. What filled him with rage is that there isn't another ideology out there. That he can't tolerate. That's what filled him with rage. That the failure to bow down to him was because it was a negation of his whole ideology, of his whole philosophy. That's what the whole thing was. If it was just an individual who, for whatever quirk, didn't want to bow down, so it could be overlooked. And then he's petty. See, Vayivas Bieno, it's petty. He doesn't want to be, he's not petty, so what? He's always nuts. Unless you want to say it's a practical thing. But there's no indication over here that Mordechai was trying to spread.
He didn't want to kill him, that was where he was going.
But he had to give him permission from the king.
I'm Mordechai. The real target was Mordechai. And the nation had to go because it was the nation of Mordechai. The nation is an extension of Mordechai.
So the king.
He always has to have a personal target. The personal target is Mordechai. It's him.
I'm Mordechai.
But he realizes, he's big enough to realize that this is more than just one person. There's a whole movement. He's a leader of a movement. So I can't... I have to eradicate that whole movement, the whole philosophy. And Mordechai found out everything that had taken place. So now we read about the response of Mordechai. Vayikra Mordechai es begadav. So Mordechai rent his garment. Vayilbash sak ba'efeh. And he put on sackcloth and ashes. Vayetze b'socha yer, and he went to the middle of the city. Vayizak za'aka gedola umara. And he let out a loud and a bitter wail. Vayavo ad lefnei shar ha'melech, and he came up to before the gates of the king. Kiyen lavo al shar ha'melech b'levushzak. Because you were not permitted to enter into the gates of the king dressed in sackcloth. Okay, so what is this? It was not, clearly it was not just a matter of personal reaction, personal feeling. Because he was this a the question we should ask is, was this purely a personal reaction, or was it a, was it a political action, so to speak? Not politics per se, but I mean, did it have an objective purpose above and beyond his personal feeling? Was it just an expression of personal feeling, or was he beginning, or was it an activity? Vayetze b'socha ir. Vayizak z'aka gedola umara. That is not personal. The first part is, vayilbash sak v'efa. The first part, there's two reactions. In Pasuk Aleph, that's the personal. Mordechai knew. Vayikra Mordechai es begadav, he tore his garments. That's kriya. That's what we do, in a situation where you lose someone that's close to you, mourning. That's kriya. Kriya is a personal act of mourning. So he was involved in a personal act of mourning. The second part, vayilbash sak va'efa, vayetze b'socha ir, vayizak, all this is not a natural result of the personal, but it is intended for a objective. And what's the objective? To arouse people, to arouse public opinion. Right? Now, he chose a specific method of doing it. This is something you have to stop and analyze. Because if his objective was to arouse the public, then we have to ask ourselves, was this the only possible method? Was he simply out of control and he had no... If a person reads this thing on a simple level, a simplistic level, so he'll say that that's the state he was in, and it was just a natural kind of thing. He really didn't think about it. Well, but we know that we're dealing with Mordechai. Mordechai Yoda, Mordechai knew. So Mordechai operates on the basis of knowledge. So therefore, there was a reason behind this. In my opinion, there was a reason behind it. So I think that we should pause and analyze what's the reason behind it. But understand that Mordechai is a great leader of Klal Yisrael. And one of the hallmarks of their greatness is that in spite of all the provocation, they act in a very calm, rational manner. With seichel. So therefore, to simply say that it's a combination, he was just in a certain state, and this naturally happened, I think would take away from Mordechai's greatness. You're just treating him like an ordinary person. It would seem to me that if he was overcome by emotion, then he would have just stayed privately until he was ready to deal with the situation. And vayetze, when you go out, you're doing something you've got to consider very, very carefully. Because if you make the wrong move, a lot of times, this is very important for practical purposes, Jewish leaders and so forth. There's a lot. We live in a world where we're constantly exposed to all kinds of provocations, political provocations, anti-Semitism or something is done about Israel and so on and so forth. And then immediately... people are asked, spokesmen are asked to respond. And a good leader is one who knows how to control the emotions. They try and get you in the moment of emotion. But you realize that once you do something, if you respond, and it's incorrect, it's off the mark because of some emotions, then you could have made a serious mistake. And it can't be taken back so easily. You have to realize also, very difficult afterwards if you've made a political mistake and then you say, well, I was under the stress, that may be nice, but people are not forgiving. Now I'm saying that Mordechai, if you're going to tell me that the second part was vayetze, was not for his own sake, then it would have been something that he had thought about. He didn't just act on the basis of an emotion. And that's why you've got to pause and analyze it. And, I agree with what you're saying, Naftali, that the Rav made an important point about this. That, see, when you're acting publicly, There's different methods you have to use. Sometimes emotionalism is not the correct procedure. Sometimes you have to be calm, you have to explain. Now, Mordechai could have acted in different ways. He could have gone out in a calm manner and explained very carefully what's going on and what we should do about it. And you would have thought that given the character of Mordechai being a great leader of Klal Yisrael, that's what he would have done. I mean, the first element is, it's for example, you see by Avraham, after the death of Sarah, it says, Vayavo Avraham, lispod l'sara v'lifkosa, that he came to be maspid her, to eulogize her, v'lifkosa, and to cry. So there's two different things over there. Interestingly enough, the hesped comes first. Now, hesped is the rational. That is the elucidation of what she stood for. That's a rational activity. Now, the bechi is the crying. That's an emotional thing. So there's two separate aspects. Now, over here, too, you would have thought that there's the personal. Of course, he was personally affected. That we understand. The kriya, the fact that he tore his garments is a measure of his emotional perfection. That this is the effect that the news had upon him. It was mourning, and it wasn't. Believe me, this was not because he was a Jew, and this would affect him. This was for Klal Yisrael. That's another thing it shows about Mordechai, that the effect that it had upon him was not because he himself was concerned. The truth of the matter is that, interestingly enough, he knew about it. He was one of the first to know about it. If he was only concerned about himself, well, he might have escaped. He was a person with influence. He had the knowledge of what was going on. He could have escaped. So clearly, the reaction was not because of anything that would happen to him. The reaction was based upon his understanding of the impact upon Klal Yisrael. But the second point was that there are times when a reasoned appeal to a person's logic is not what is called for, and you have to have what is needed is a loud and bitter wail. That's what's needed to move people. But the Rav said, when he criticized the Jews during World War II, he said they were too quiet. Even when they went about protesting, or to the government, or whatever it was, but it was all done in a nice, orderly fashion. No one went out into the streets he said that this is what was called for. That situation demanded that the Jews should have gone into the streets and torn their garments and put on sackcloth and a loud, bitter wail. Why? Because people are not affected. Very few people are affected by the objective nature of the calamity. It has to be brought home to them in a very strong emotional way. There are stories you read about some of the cases where they were able to break through to the government leaders. Some of the Gedolim in America, some rabbis went to Washington to meet with the Treasury Secretary. He happened to be Jewish, but he was an assimilated Jew. And you know, the government bureaucracy was basically geared towards pushing, you know, they had it all worked out very, very smoothly. You know, they like to maintain contact with the more assimilated type of sophisticated Jews, and they explain to them all the problems, and you know, and they bought that line, and they sort of went back to the Jewish community and said that, you know, the basic line was, there's nothing we can do. We can't intervene directly for the Jews, and as soon as we win, you know, the Jews have to be loyal. As soon as we win the war, then the Hitler will be put out of business and so forth. But of course, the need was for immediate action to save Jews. So there was a group of rabbis, you know, from Europe with beards and so forth, and they wouldn't be put aside. You know, they clearly were following the example of Mordechai. And he writes about this. I think it's the Treasury. I think it's Morgenthau. I mean, I have to check it out. That, you know, they had this group, and they sent an emissary, whatever it was, and they refused to leave. They wanted to meet just with him. And finally, he had to meet with them, and they just sat down and they broke down and cried in front of him. And he said, they're wailing. And he writes afterwards, he said he couldn't get that out, he couldn't sleep that night. He couldn't get it out of his mind. And that had an effect, you know, he did whatever he could do. So you see that that's part of the
that too is necessary. That sometimes you have to measure the situation. Sometimes you have to operate on the basis of a reasonable appeal. But sometimes that's not sufficient. The person has to see the effect that it has upon you. And you have to go out and scream aloud and bitter scream. And that's what makes an impact upon people. That's what Mardukhai did over here. That's why Vayetze B'Sochayir was a calculated decision. I'm not saying he was faking it. He felt it. But even though my point is that the fact that he felt it would not have determined that he did it. He did it because this was the proper thing to do. Okay? Now, it says that so there was tremendous mourning, say, for the Jews, v'tzom u'b'chi u'mispeid, fasting and crying and wailing. Sakva eifa yutzal aravim. Okay. Now, the next thing is very interesting. The encounter, sort of a confrontation between Esther and Mordechai. Now, word gets back to Esther. Apparently, Esther did not know what was going on, because her servants tell her what? They tell her about Mordechai. That Mordechai is going around dressed in sackcloth. You know, the strange behavior of Mordechai. So she was upset by it. So she sent the garments to Mordechai to remove his sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept it. So then...
Why did she do that?
Huh? That's a good question. So CD is asking, why did she do that? Yeah, it's a good question, because what she should have done was...
Ask him why he did
it. Yeah. I mean, it's a little preemptory. She assumed automatically that it was wrong and that he should be dressed in proper clothing. But what she should have done is to find out if Mordechai is doing this, why is he doing it? All right? Well, let's wait a while. Let's see what happens. So Esther called Hasach, one of the assistants of the king who he had placed before her, and commanded him to go to Mordechai, Ladas Mazev. Now, Ladas Mazev, Yal Mazev, to find out what this is all about. Okay, so then Hasach came to Mordechai, and Mordechai told him everything that had occurred, and the apportionment of the money that Haman had mentioned to give to the treasury of the king to destroy the Jews, and also about the texts that were sent out to destroy them. He gave to him to show to Esther. Now here's the key point. Because he explained, of course he explained why he was doing this, but then he had a specific message for Esther to tell her, to command her to go to the king, to plead, to petition him and to plead before him for her nation. So in other words, Mordechai's plan, after going around throughout the city and arousing, you know, the proper response, what was the plan? The plan was for Esther to go and plead before the king. Which made sense, because who else was in a position to do anything about this? The only one that was in a position to do anything about this was Esther. So what's she supposed to do? To go and plead for mercy. Now you have an interesting dialogue. You have an interesting dialogue between Esther and Mordechai. So it says that Hasach came and told to Esther the words of Mordechai. So what was the response of Esther? So Esther said to Hasach, she spoke to Hasach and commanded him to Mordechai. And take a look at the answer, and that's Yud Aleph, that all of the servants of the king and all the nations of the king know that any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner chamber, who has not been called, there's one law for them, that they're to be killed. Except for the one to whom the king stretches forth the golden scepter, and that person can live. Okay, so there was a danger involved that you simply, she was saying, I just can't do what he's telling me to do, because if I do that, then you could be killed. Okay? And I have not been called to come to the king for the past 30 days. So basically, it's a pretty, I mean, given the Megillah, it doesn't like to have excessive description. It's a little bit of a lengthy answer. Kalam, everybody knows, and this and that. She goes to the, basically, she can't go. Her answer to the request is no, with an explanation. With regrets. Right? At this point, her answer makes sense. Her answer seems to be reasonable. And Mordechai said to return to retort to Esther. Let's analyze carefully the response of Mordechai. Is it justified? So it seems to me that he's giving her a bit of a rebuke. Al tadami v'nafshech, do not imagine in your soul the Molech beis hamelech mikol ha-Yehudim, that you will be saved in the house of the king from all the Jews. That's a serious accusation. Where did she say? Where did she propose that she would be able to escape from the calamity? All she said was, I haven't been called these 30 days. And he's saying, don't imagine that that you'll be saved. For if you'll be silent at this time, then salvation and deliverance will come to the Jews from a different place. But you and your father's house will be lost. And who knows, if not for a time like this, did you reach the kingship? Did you reach Malchus, this royal position? I'm sorry? Yeah. Im la'eis kazos. For a time, what did I say? For a time, yeah. That's the sense, I believe. Mi'adei im la'eis kazos. Who knows? Maybe it's... I mean, the implication is that this is possibly the whole reason why you're the queen in the first place. Was nothing else but for a time like this. And that's it. Then, of course... the response of Esther, apparently Esther was very moved by this message, and then she says, Lech kenos kol Yehudim in Shushan. Then she gets back to him and says, gather all the Jews in Shushan and fast for me and do not eat or drink 3 days, night and day. And Gamani v'narosai osim kein, also I and my maidens will also fast. Thus, ubechein avo lamelech ha-sheloch hadas. And then I will go to the king, in violation of the law, without an appointment. And if I'm lost, I'm lost. If that's what my fate is, I accept my fate. So basically she accepts. And then she launches her plan. So the next thing we'll try, and we're not going to do that today, the next thing will be the actual plan. Because it seems to me, if you study the plan of Esther, I'd like you to look ahead to tomorrow. If you study the plan of Esther, I mean, you have to ask yourself, what was her plan, and did she simply follow the advice of Mordechai? Because Mordechai's advice was to go and plead. But let's analyze the dialogue. What was the, so to speak, machlokus? There seems to be that there was a machlokus between Mordechai and Esther, because Mordechai has specific instructions for Esther. At first, she refuses, and it seems, on logical ground. And then he sort of breaks her down, and the breakdown, it's not that clear what he's saying. On the surface it would seem that her answer makes sense, but she exceeds. So let's see if we can elucidate those points. Okay?
I was proposing that she should go immediately. Now, did he know, was he aware of this rule? That, in other words, like this, Esther's answer was that what you're proposing does not make sense because of this rule. There's a rule in effect over here. Now the question is, was Mordechai aware of that rule or not? Now, if he was aware of the rule, so then why was he subjecting her to this type of danger? If he wasn't aware of the rule, then our answer should have been fine. Our answer should have been fine. Now, what was her answer also? In responding to her, it seems that he's accusing her of not really of lacking concern for the Jews. Well, he may be threatening her, but he's also accused us for certain, for sure. He's definitely accusing her of something very serious. You don't really care. Was that what she said? What was Esther's answer? Was Esther's answer basically that don't count on me, I can't do anything for you, get lost, so to speak? Or was she saying something different? What was she really saying here? See, he's asking. Because, first of all, that whole thing, that the Revach Vatzala Yamod La'yud Mimokam Acher, that deliverance will emerge for the Jews from another place, is not so easy to understand. What exactly are you talking about? So if that's the case, so what's the problem? I can't say, okay, if I'm not needed, either I'm needed or I'm not needed. If you're going to tell me that if I don't act, then some deliverance will come from another place. So, okay, so that's not the kind of message you want to give to somebody. Because when you want to appeal to somebody, you want to give them the idea that without you, we're lost. Everything depends upon you. That's what people do, right? When they approach you for any cause, whether it be for a situation in yeshiva, whatever it is, we're turning to you. And you say, well, there are other people out there as well. No. So for whatever reason, it's just you. It all depends on you. Right? When you want to get a person. Also, CD is asking a good question. If it is true that deliverance will come from a different quarter, so then why will she be destroyed in her father's house? So then she'll be, that deliverance will, what, the deliverance will bypass her because of the fact that she refused now? What's he talking about over here? Is that a threat? How does he know these things? I think Moshe's point is correct. Esther was not refusing. What she meant was that the plan that you're giving me doesn't make any sense because it entails a serious risk. So why not wait until he calls me, or if not, apply for an appointment? That's not mentioned openly. All she's saying is, what you're telling me to do is to make a sudden dramatic appearance before the king, out of nowhere. But achas damo das olahamis. I mean, he can, by doing that, I can get killed. Now, I don't even think she's, forget about my life. Forget about my life. But then you've lost the whole opportunity. Does it not make more sense to wait? To wait and to get an appointment. Yeah, that's doable. I mean, it's hard to imagine that... They had 11 months to go. It was set for Adar. So they had 11 months to go. And there's no doubt that it made more practical sense to go about it carefully. I assume if we were in a situation like that, contemplating getting an appointment with someone and counting the risks and so on and so forth, then we'd certainly say, don't just appear at the governor's mansion, at the king's mansion, whatever it is, that's crazy. They could throw you in jail, let's say. Go through the channels and get an appointment, and you'll have your 15 minutes, whatever it is, you'll make your case. Seems to be. Now, that's all Esther is saying. Moshe's correct. But Mordechai rejects. And you see that she agrees. Chashar avadati avadati. Apparently part of Mordechai's, apparently Mordechai did know. Mordechai knew what was going on. Apparently we can therefore infer that he did know about this rule, about the risk, and he, not only was he not concerned about it, but he held that that's part of the plan. To take that risk is essential. Now, what's the machlokas? But on the surface, it would seem from a pragmatic point of view that Esther makes more sense. Tzvi points out that she was not yet ready. She was not wearing sak ve'efer. In fact, she didn't want him to be wearing sak ve'efer. That might be of significance over here. She wanted him to get out of that clothing.
That would fit in. Basically,
you see, when she goes to the king, she dresses in malchus, Vatulbash Esther malchus. But that fits, I think that's part of her plan. Okay. What Tzidi is saying is that the machlokas over here was, and Mordechai held that she has to be moser nefesh. That she has an obligation. Her point was that it does not make sense to put my life on the line. Mordechai's point was, but the only way that this thing can succeed is if you put your life on the line. Because otherwise it will not make the proper impact. Because if you use other factors, you're saying that this, the thing that I need over here, you have to realize what's going to make an impact on the king is how important this is to you. It's so important to you that you're prepared to...